Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, welcome to Teach Me to Talk with Laura and Kate. I'm Laura Mize, pediatric speech language pathologist.
And I'm Kate Hensler, developmental interventionist with the First Steps program here in Louisville, Kentucky. Hi, Laura.
Hi, we'd like to welcome you to our show today. It's Thursday, August 27th, 2 p.m. Eastern Time, and if you're listening now, you're listening live, and again, welcome to our show. This week, we're continuing our discussion of apraxia and phonological disorders in young children, and we've been talking about this for several weeks now, so we're not going to review all of the previous shows. If you've not had a chance to listen to this series, though, and your child has been diagnosed with apraxia or a phonological disorder, or if your kid is talking but he's really, really, really hard to understand, or maybe you know that he's smart and he understands a lot, but he's still not really using too many words, apraxia or a severe phonological disorder might explain some of that. So I'd really encourage you to go back and listen to our other shows. And you can also find information about that on my website, and that's at teachmetotalk.com, so take a look at that. And I also have a DVD on sale now specifically that talks about all the characteristics and that shows you examples of children who have these kinds of issues, and more importantly, gives you the very same therapy techniques that we're going to be talking about today. And if listening to this is not quite enough and you're not exactly sure what I mean by some of the things that we're going to talk about, I'd really encourage you to get the DVD so that you can see those techniques and see how it's done with real children. Kate, you want to talk about anything before we get going today?
Well, no, except to add that it's been interesting over the, almost a year now, I guess you've been at the doing your DVD ventures. Sometimes it's so much easier to do it than it is to explain it.
Yeah.
And it's certainly easier to do it when you're able to watch somebody do it. So sometimes it's hard to put into words and much easier to imitate the behavior. So,
you know, sometimes it is harder to put into words because yesterday we had this same conversation where I saw a little girl for the first time and I'm replacing someone else, and her occupational therapist suggested that I take a look at her because she feels that she has apraxia, and again, that's a speech motor planning disorder, and she feels that way because of all the motor planning things that she observed with her in play and in fine motor, and had a great first session with her. And so, of course, I, you know, leave the house, talk to my husband, talk to you. I'm on my giddy. Woo-hoo-hoo, she did so good. Hi. And I said to you, I'm still not sure that I can put into words exactly what it is that kind of gets these kids and makes, kind of turns the switch on for them. And it's hard. I mean, even in this last year when I've really been thinking about, okay, exactly what do I do? How do I explain this to parents? What's going to make the most sense to say? When I'm really sitting down working with a kid, what are the things that I'm thinking and doing? And not all what the textbooks say or the, you know, the class, when you take the class on treating speech disorders in kids, you know, even if you were lucky enough in grad school to actually get a real class on that beyond the theory, you know, it's still kind of hard to put into words or to really explain what you just kind of instinctively start to do after you've worked with kids like that for a long time. So I'm hoping that in the shows and through the DVDs and through articles on the website that you can get the information that you need to help you make your changes when you work with, if you're a speech pathologist or a developmental interventionist like Kate, when you start to work with these kids, that some of these things kind of kick in with you too, and it just kind of takes over and you kind of do these things instinctively, even if you're not quite sure why it works. Just know that it works, but hopefully,
kind of the way I was in math. I didn't really need to know the theory. I just wanted to know how to work the problem. So I guess maybe that's the way I am in a number of avenues of my life, huh, Laura? But, yeah, because the theory can be somewhat confusing, but the actual implementation is very much something that anybody who was willing and interested in learning could pretty much learn. But
yeah, and I think it does take just kind of watching it and then imitating it again. And even if you're a parent and you're thinking, I don't understand, I still don't know what she means by phonological disorder, you know, don't get hung up on that. Just go with taking the strategies, the basic strategies, and implementing those and seeing how those work out for your child. All right. Today we're talking about kind of the continuation from last week. We started last week talking about first words and how we kind of decide what words when we're working with a child that we're going to try to elicit. You know, an elicit is a fancy word for we set up the situation, we do everything we can to make sure that a child might repeat what we say or, you know, choose to imitate the words that we're using. And so today we're going to continue talking about that, but we're going to talk about it from a phonological perspective. And I think last week we sort of started talking about this when we were saying, okay, if he's got a good M for mama, then we might think, oh, let's try to get other words that start with M, you know. Or, and then we started talking about, okay, what sounds would be related to M? What other sounds could we get? Well, M is a lip sound, so we might try words that start with P and words that start with B. And Kate, you were talking about that, and I teased you and said, do you know what you just did? That's treatment from a phonological perspective. So that's what
and
we're
I said, yeah, about. Yeah, yeah. I just want to get the words. I don't really care about the theory, but yeah. I mean, and it, you know, because I have not really had formal training other than what Laura has given me, and I've certainly done some speechy type trainings and read things related to speech development, but have never gone to graduate school to become a speech therapist. So my things are pretty much learned in the trenches, and I may not always know the theory, but I could probably sit with many speech therapists and say, this is the next logical word, a lot of times because I know that's what I could get so many kids to say next. You know?
Right, yeah.
Right. So.
Yeah. And so today we are going to talk a little bit about the theory of that, but again, don't get lost in this. If your eyes are glazing over, try to think about something else until you hear something that makes sense to you again. Or kind of think about it, and even if you're not truly understanding it, don't worry about it and don't get hung up on it. But we're going to try to explain it in a way that makes sense, and again, so that you don't have to have a master's degree in speech pathology to understand it. And let me tell you, some of the people who understand the theory can't get it on the floor.
A lot of them is the truth. It's almost like, I don't know, it's a rare combination to get both. So, Laura, let me ask you something, though, and I didn't warn you about this question, but it's not a tricky one, but I just was kind of thinking to myself and wondering if any listeners might be wondering, do you think, I mean, let's say this, if you had a child who was minimally verbal or nonverbal, maybe had 3-4 words, you know, but they were, you know, because we've talked in the past about the importance of them really being having a social connection and that joint attention and those things were present, and it looked to you and to the family like comprehension, they were understanding a lot of what was said to them, but really just a couple of actual words. It really doesn't matter if it's apraxia or a phonological disorder at that point, does it?
At that point, I don't think it really does. And, you know, I am so engrossed in motor planning, and I really, and this is so against what so many experts would say, but I'm just going to say it anyway, I really think that poor motor planning is at the root of lots of children that are like what you described. Now, mm-hmm. The literature says it's only 7-8% of all the children that are diagnosed with language delays have a motor speech disorder, and I would totally want to argue with that, because I mean, just in looking at the children that I've seen over the last, you know, 10 to 15 years, I really think that it's more of a problem than people recognize or that people are willing to talk about. And I think, you know, as 20 years from now, people may really agree with me, and it doesn't even matter to me if they do or not. I just think that it really, motor planning is so prevalent, such an important thing, that it really affects more children than we think, and that the techniques that we're talking about really work even with kids that don't, that wouldn't get that diagnosis. So in my mind, it doesn't really matter what I call it or what
right.
a therapist calls it. I'm going to just do these kinds of things because this is what I know works, again,
right.
from a theoretical
right.
perspective, but more importantly, from being in lots and lots of homes with lots and lots of different children with different issues. And even if they come in with a diagnosis, like that little girl I saw yesterday, her therapist still was just saying language delay. She wasn't looking at motor planning at all. The physical therapist that saw her for darn near a year, who couldn't figure out why she couldn't do things like climb and go up steps and play on playground equipment, she finally referred her to an OT thinking it was sensory. And the first OT agreed and treated her a little bit and then discharged her because her fine motor was great, you know, because her grasp was good. And then the second, the mom, you know, kept saying, gosh, there's still something else going on. And the second OT that came in said, gosh, this is a motor planning problem. So, again, I think even therapists can disagree on that or not know what to call it, and it doesn't matter because when you implement the techniques, you know, again, it doesn't matter. And the reason that I grouped apraxia and phonological disorders together to kind of think about it and do it is because that's what therapists go back and forth on. And I think as a speech pathologist, you can drive yourself nutty sitting there trying to decide, is it apraxia? Is it a phonological disorder? Which one is it? Which one is it? Who cares?
Right.
Just get going on these kinds of things. And some therapists would really hate that I just said that and would think that that's so irreverent and that you have to have an official diagnosis before you get started. No, you don't. You know, you just want to kind of treat it like it's a speech thing versus, you know, solely thinking about a language thing. And I probably better back up and explain that when you do the kinds of techniques that we talked about last week, you know, we talked about kind of pushing them and using signs to get the words going and then really doing some cueing strategies. If you are, you know, and those are speech disorder techniques. Language techniques, and again, I think language is so much more important than this speech stuff unless you have a therapist that just thinks, well, if it's a language disorder, I'm just going to narrate what they do. It's just because they haven't totally learned the words yet. And if you've got a kid with great comprehension who's following lots of directions, she knows the words. She understands. It's not that. It's at that point, more than likely, speech is also a component. By speech, I mean the way that you produce the sounds, the way that your tongue and your lips and your kind of neurological connection, getting it from your brain to your mouth, that has to be a component with kids who have great comprehension, who have that social connection and all of that. So you have to think about it sometimes in the context of this is a speech disorder and I've got to do these little motor planning things, even though, gosh, I don't think I'm explaining myself very well. Even though language is more important, do you see what you know what I'm thinking? But I'm having a hard time articulating it. You know, I say all the time, language is more important than speech. Language is more important than speech. Yes, unless you have a kid that you've used all these languagey kinds of things and you still can't get speech going, then you kind of want to back up and do some of these things. Does that make sense?
I believe it does.
Okay. I'm breaking out in sweat because I think I'm not explaining it.
No, I think it does, and I just kind of wanted to get that point out there for parents because, like you said, there's a wide amount of variance between what therapists call things, who's willing to call it, you know, and if you're sitting there thinking, I've never heard the word apraxia or phonological disorder, they just say he's language delayed. They just say he's a late talker. They just say, but, you know, perhaps your child's been in speech therapy for a while and isn't really making the kind of progress you feel like he should be able to make, particularly based on how well he or she seems to understand things. I'm just saying at this point, not that in the future you wouldn't want to get some kind of firm diagnosis, but right now, you know, as most mothers just want their kids to be able to tell them what they want, you know, to talk to them a little bit. So it doesn't matter. I mean, it's just, it may matter down the road, but day-to-day, and I think this is pretty universal. Parents just want their kids to be able to talk, and whether we call it apraxia or a phonological disorder, you know, they go, mm-hmm, so can you fix them?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so just want to make that point.
Yeah, and I hope the answer is yes, and that a therapist doesn't get so hung up on that.
Right.
Another thing that I think a lot of therapists do is somehow they think that phonological disorders are less scary to parents, or it's easier to call it that, or somehow easier to treat. And so they call it that instead of saying apraxia, even when they kind of in their own minds think, okay, this is a real motor speech disorder, rather than, I think a lot of therapists feel like they go out on a limb when they diagnose apraxia, and that, you know, and sometimes I even feel like that, like somebody else is going to pounce on me and say, no, they're not apraxic, blah, blah, blah. you know, they did not meet the official diagnostic criteria. And again, I say, who cares? You know, as long as these, if you put these strategies in place and as long as they start to work, you know, again, who cares? And the truth is, lots of children who do have apraxia do have some patterns that would be considered phonological disorders. And I read that in somebody's, like over the winter when I was really, remember when I was having my big philosophical revelation, Kate, and I was really debating, okay, exactly what am I going to put in this DVD? And it was the only place that I found it that where an expert really definitively said,
see, and I have been meaning to blurt that out, but then I thought, oh, Laura will probably be mad if I say it. But it does seem to me that there is some crossover there. That
total crossover.
Not totally black and white on that.
It's not. It's not. And I think a lot of therapists try to split hairs on that and say it's one or the other. And that's the thing that happens so many times with children that I treat and feel like, okay, we had a, you know, they were apraxic and had a big motor planning disorder, and then they go to school and the school speech pathologist says he can't be apraxic because he's really talking now. Mm-hmm. And you think, hello, yes, he was. And what about this whole gear of therapy that we've done? What do you think mm-hmm. we've been doing, twiddling our fingers? We don't just diagnose him and then let it go. You know, kids with apraxia really do talk. They really do make good progress. And so I think that's another kind of misperception that a lot of people say is, gosh, if he's talking it great at five, he never could have been apraxic. And I totally disagree with that. Totally.
Right.
Okay.
I mean, I always think, well, that's the case for good early therapy, you know.
Yeah. Well, and that goes back to that whole discussion about neuroplasticity, meaning that mm-hmm. we really can change how a kid's brain is wired. And I firmly believe that with every fiber of my being and my brain is that if you do the right things early enough, you really can change all that and kind of change the course of how they would have turned out had you not done anything or if you had done things that were wrong. And not, I don't mean wrong. I just mean you didn't give them enough of the right stuff. So that's my own personal philosophy on that. And then I heard one expert say at the in a little informal discussion at the end last time she was in Louisville, she was talking to kind of a group of us that had all huddled around her in awe, and she said, I really believe that kids with phonological disorders are kids that have apraxia, they've just gotten better, and we call it. Well, that's what I believe too. I thought, finally somebody else has said out loud.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
You know,
that's the way
it
looks to me. If
yeah.
If you help them, they make progress. What looked like apraxia in the beginning, as they come along and become more and more verbal, you do begin to see some patterns in their ears.
You really do.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if you spend enough time with them. And again, I hope some really famous person doesn't call in the show right now and disagree with me. But
I hope they do. I'm always bugging Laura because she's always talking about the experts. And I always say, you are the expert. What are you talking about? I can stack you up against anybody.
Well, but what I'm saying is, theoretically,
right.
I think some people that don't really work with children anymore
mm-hmm.
or somebody from a purely academic aspect might really argue that point, but again, until you've seen lots of children that aren't just black and white, there's a whole lot of gray. And so I think that that's really what's changed my mind about that, is because, you know, I work with kids every day instead of just reading about it and writing about it.
Right. And we say we don't like the theory. I guess the truth is we do like the theory.
Yeah.
But
I like
really,
the theory. I think
yeah.
about the theory all the time.
It's interesting, but you know, day-to-day, what we really care about is, okay, what do you do to make it better?
Right, and I'm always trying to connect theory with real practice,
mm-hmm.
and that's what I think I have been called to do, because
right.
lots of people get the theory, and there are a good number of people who are good with making it work, but I want to kind of make that connection so more people can be better at making it work. So there you go. Okay, let's get back to this, though. With phonological disorders, again, remember that children with phonological disorders, that formal definition is that they have difficulties organizing how signs are used in, not signs, I'm sorry, how sounds are used in their mind.
Oh, wait a minute.
You need to jump in if I am.
Laura's a little tired today. She's been working so hard getting her DVD
yeah.
to market,
this
latest
yeah.
apraxia DVD. So I think she's I knew you knew that, but
I know, and I've seen 20 kids in 3 days, and I've had too much caffeine. Anyway, okay. So difficulty organizing sounds in their mind. So in their at the cognitive level, they don't understand which sounds go with which words. And again, with these kids, the theory is that they can get it from brain to mouth fine, and that those connections are there. It just, the disruption occurs kind of in at the cognitive level in their little minds, how they think about words and how they think about saying the word and how they organize saying the word before they even, before that little brain fires and sends that message to their mouth to move in this way, that it's disrupted up there in the very initial stage. And so, again, that's the theory. And the theory with apraxia would be that the kid knows how to say it and understands what sounds go in the right place. It just misfires between their brain and mouth. And, again, that's just a very basic layman explanation. I would never say that to a group of medical students or, you know, even my doctor mommy. So I think it's okay that I explain it in that way because that's the way that kind of makes sense. So if we're talking about treating children from a phonological perspective, we're talking about helping them change the way that they think about sounds or the way that they organize sounds. And I can tell that you're thinking already, how do you get a 2-year-old to change the way he thinks about sounds?
Yeah,
well, again, we have to get it from theory to the floor. So for kids that you that have been diagnosed with that problem, you're going to focus on, you're not going to focus on the specific sounds. You're focusing on the specific patterns. And let me give you the best example that I think of when I think of this. I think about kids, you know, somewhere between 2 and 3, kids with typically developing language, and usually on the earlier end if they had typically developing speech, they start to include sounds at the ends of words. So ha, hot is hot instead of ha. Hat is hat instead of ha. And so they learn, oh, my gosh, my mommy puts a sound on the end of that word. I'm going to start sticking that sound there, too. So for a kid with messed up phonology or a phonological disorder, he doesn't get that whole, oh, there's supposed to be something on the end of that. So what you do when you create your therapy activities is you really want to help them realize that sound is there. And you can't really say, Isaac, you are never articulating final consonants in your words when you tell mommy what you want. You can't do it that way. You just have to model, you know, hat, hot, boot, you know, dot, all the little words that you're using. You're going to really model that. Some experts really like when you overemphasize that and overarticulate that. It's always interesting to me when I go to meetings with other speech pathologists and you're just talking to them out in the driveway and they're just talking like we are, and then they get in the meeting and it is, they turn on their professional voices and everything is very precisely articulated, you know, and I can't even do it like some of those folks do because I'm so Southern and naturally so sing-songy and slangy anyway. But when I hear those speech pathologists work with those other children, they do sometimes a better job of kind of that over-articulation. And again, some people, some therapists really disagree with that, and they want everything to be so naturalistic. But for kids who aren't getting it, you really do want to emphasize the pattern that you're trying to do. Last week we talked about that we called sounds certain names. Some people, when they treat phonological disorders, would really do something like saying our ending sounds. You know, we're going to get our ending sounds. And again, that's not something you would really do with a 2-year-old, but something that a 4 or 5 or 6-year-old, you might really start to call attention to it in that way. But when you are treating this at home, you know, again, with a toddler, 2 or 3-year-old, you really are going to think about, okay, he doesn't have any consonants at the ends, so we're going to exaggerate that. And so when you're playing with trains, you're going to do, you know, give me the tracks, where's the top, you know, and really you're not just focusing on that ending S or that ending P. In your mind, you're thinking, I'm focusing on ending sounds, whatever the ending sound would be. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I am kind of wondering, Laura, again, this is my deep thinking day, I guess. How in the world would a speech therapist ever know, working with a child, if this is, as you say, phonological, and he doesn't have the cognitive concept of putting endings on words, or it's a praxic and all he can get out is the very first part of a simple word?
They only know from looking at those characteristics that we talked about at the beginning. If his vowels are also screwed up, they're probably going with apraxia. If his vowels are great and he can imitate things great, even if it's off target, and he doesn't ever have hesitations with imitating, and he can string lots of syllables together, his jargon is, you know, tons of different sounds. Mm-hmm. They're going to go with phonological disorders.
Okay.
If he can stick his tongue out and wiggle it and pucker up and make his cheeks real big, great. They're going to think, okay, it's more phonological. If he can't do any of that because he can't imitate those oral mouth movements, they're going to think it's more apraxia. So mm-hmm. I think that they use the diagnostic characteristics that we talked about weeks ago, and would kind of make their determinations based on that, not whether or not he can include final sounds.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's how I think about it, too.
I'm going with your earlier premise that apraxia is more common because I don't see too many kids who are that minimally verbal but have great comprehension who can do all those things you were talking about.
I know. And listen, but when you do see it, it's kind of funny because, you know, all the years that I've spent in church nursery, I really use my time well in there saying, hey, can you do this?
Yeah.
And really try to get them to imitate. And it is surprising. You know, we work with disordered kids, delayed kids. So we don't see normal all the time. And so I think sometimes our perception of normal, like, well, hardly any 2-year-old can do that. After doing church nursery forever, man, most 2-year-olds can do it.
Oh, yeah. I mean of the kids who I see through work, you know, for therapy, who are really, really delayed on talk, you know, their expressive skills are way behind their receptive skills. I don't see too many who can do those things you were just talking about.
That's why
so
I think.
But I mean, 12-month-olds can do a lot of those things like a pro.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, my kids were, and you probably remember this from your kids too, you know, and I was the kind of new mom, even in my 20s, that boy, I had the checklist out going, okay, it says that he should be able to imitate my mouth movements by 4 months. How can that be? And write down in their little faces, and lo and behold, they did it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and really doing all this great coordinated oral motor stuff from really early on. So, I think most of the kids, like you said, that we do get in early intervention, sometimes those diagnoses of motor speech or motor planning disorders really are overlooked because therapists have read, oh, no, only 7-8% of kids with delays could actually be diagnosed with apraxia. Well, how come I've got 30 of them on my caseload? You know, how can that be? The odds can't be there. And I think, yes, it can, just you know, evaluate kids on a kid-by-kid basis and don't think about the norms or don't think about, oh, gosh, I'm over-diagnosing this or I'm overthinking about it in that way. That's like that day that you and I had lunch with a therapist. This was, oh, gosh, over a year ago, where she said she never had any kids with autism on her caseload.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think on one hand, okay, that's just not possible. And then on the other hand, I think, well, maybe what if she really didn't get those kind of referrals? You know, you really can't think about terms. You really have to just look at each kid on an individual basis, although that's probably not a good example because I don't.
Well, you know,
that.
Laura, let's think about it. We know autism's on the rise. We know asthma's on the rise. We know what's the other one, the skin one?
Eczema.
Eczema's on the rise.
Yeah.
Maybe apraxia's on the rise, too.
Maybe so. And it would stand to reason that, you
it
know,
would.
And just from what you said, you know, and you kind of see a different population than I do. I get lots of apraxic kids, you know, because just kind of from the referrals and other therapists kind of know what you're good at treating and good at fixing and what you like. So, you know, you get the referrals. But you might get kids that are kind of overall globally delayed.
Right.
Well, I mean, that's all the kids you get. But do you know what I'm saying is,
not really, because I do see some kids really for speech.
Well, you do, and I forgot about that whole group of kids that you see.
But usually, if the DI were seeing a child, they would have
global
yes
delays.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but if you think about those kids, And, okay, if they're just a little bit behind, by the time that they're 15 or 18 months, they should be able to do a lot of this mouth stuff too, but they can't do it.
Mm-hmm.
And these are kids, and I'm not even talking about kids with low tone, you know, kids who have that muscular component as well. I'm talking about kids that, you know, probably walked on time or, you know, toward the late end of the spectrum. You know, that's not counting the kids that have all the gross motor things too.
Right.
So anyway. All right, we're getting off on a tangent, but I could talk about that kind of thing all day.
Yeah.
And we do. There you go. Pretty
much.
I know. See, you like the theory more than you think you do.
I do, but I get tired of going to official trainings where, you know, they say you're gonna learn about autism and what to do about it, and you get 6 hours of what it, you know, the theory, and you get 20 minutes of what to do about it. So.
Well, let me tell you, if I ever get to the point that I'm doing the continuing education stuff and lots of those conferences, it will be 30 minutes about diagnostics and the whole rest of 5.5 hours on intervention, because that is the most important thing.
Right.
Okay. All right. So we're talking about picking our therapy targets or picking which words we're going to work on kind of through patterns. And so, again, your speech-language pathologist may be more helpful, or I hope, would be your best resource with helping you decide kind of what you're targeting. And, again, if your kid only has 10 or 15 words, you're going to want anything, and you're going to want any word that you can get and any sound that you can get, and you're going to be happy with that. This is just a way for you to kind of think about it and not, again, I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. You're still pushing for words, and you're still pushing for any kind of approximation. We're just talking about kind of the technical stuff that if you are having a hard time getting any words, where you back up and start to think about, oh, boy, okay, he's got a pretty good P when he says pop, so let me think about what other words that I might be able to get there. Or, gosh, he can say up. He's got a good P at the end of that. I wonder if I could get a good P at the ends of other words, like pop, or like, okay, help me out. Yeah. Any, where you're going to think about what sound he has in one word and how you can move that into another new word. And, again, you're looking for those patterns here. And I will say, and we're not going to talk about this here, but there are, and this throws another monkey wrench in it, sometimes there are what the professional term is called phonetic contexts, meaning that there, with certain consonants, other vowels are easier to make a kid more likely to produce a consonant. And again, don't you think that's way too technical to talk about here? But if you're that kind of mom, you need to talk to your speech pathologist about that and say, okay, do you think he can't get this word because the vowel combination, you know, right there beside each other, that's too hard. And your speech therapist should be able to kind of think that through. Even if she doesn't know right off the top of her head, she should be able to think about that and then next week give you an answer. And really, but we're not going to talk about that today.
I find it somewhat interesting, but, you know, my understanding, like I said, is really just from what I've learned. And I definitely do see that sometimes certain sounds or blended sounds, you know, if they, why can this child say mama but can't say whatever, move, or why can this child say, I had one the other day, she can say bye, she can say a lot of B words, ball, but could not, when she was saying something about the bath, she totally lost the B. So.
Yeah.
You might be able to tell me why that was. I just realized, didn't sound a bit like bath, but.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, you know, in a lot of kids, there's a lot of kids with apraxia, their single words sound pretty darn good, but then when they start going to do phrases, their single words, even things that they can say by themselves and get all of the parts, all of the sounds on there, really might fall apart when they try to do it with a phrase. And some kids, you know, God help them when they start trying to talk in sentences,
mm-hmm.
because that's when it really, really gets bad. I have a little girl right now whose mom is an OT, and I hadn't seen her they were on a great vacation. They were gone for almost 2 weeks. And when I saw her, I walked in the house, she said, Laura, she's getting worse instead of better. And it really is because she's been talking in 2 and 3 word phrases, and she's pretty intelligible. Mm-hmm. But now she's trying to talk in 7 and 8 word sentences,
mm-hmm.
and she's losing lots of her sounds. So, again, I would think that that little girl is apraxic because she can do those sounds in single words and in short phrases, but it's the sequencing that makes it all fall apart.
Right. And that is certainly common with kids that I suspect, and I don't ever diagnose them officially, but sometimes I think, a speech therapist, a good one anyway, might recognize this is apraxia, but it's very common. They get, you know, I a lot of times warn parents of that. Don't be surprised that
right.
when they're using more words to form phrases or sentences, and that's what we want, it's probably going to be harder to understand them.
Yeah, and you just know that they're going to probably have to go through that yucky period of kind of resetting to get all those sounds in the right places, and that's okay. I mean, that's okay. That's something
right.
that's a normal thing that we would expect to see.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, one thing I did want to talk about kind of in this section of phonological principles is that sometimes children with apraxia can do hard sounds. Like you might hear a kid that barely has any consonants at all, and lo and behold, he's saying an R.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you think, oh, my gosh, where did that come from? You know, knowing what we know about speech sound development, we usually think about P, M, B, you know, D, T. Those sounds usually come first. How the heck can he, you know, not do mama, but he can, you know, do a, you know, for the car. And again, sometimes children with apraxia do not follow that normal sequence of sound acquisition. They start to say sounds that you think, you know, that's an old sound. You know, a lot of times in elementary school, that might be a therapist's primary caseload is fixing R. You know, lots of kids with R problems. And, you know, how in the world can this 2-year-old who, you know, it has 3 words, how can he have a good R? And so sometimes those sounds kind of pop up out of the blue, or you might get a kid that can say K's and G's really great, and, you know, we think about those as like 3-year-old sounds. A lot of 2.5 to 3-year-olds, you know, they're that old before they can say a K or a G. But, boy, a kid might have his first word might be go, and the G is perfect. So sometimes with these kids, you're not necessarily going to want to go in order with, and this is, again, mostly for the therapists that are listening, you want to go with what a kid can do. So if you have a kid that can do a G at the beginning, you know, think about your G words that you can work into with life. It would be really, really functional. And, again, if you're a mom listening to this, just pay attention to what sounds he can do and try to get those in other contexts. Or you think, okay, he can do a G. K, is that sound related to a G because it's produced at the back of your mouth? The only difference is that voice is turned on for a G and it's unvoiced for a K. Let me do some K words here. I bet it can sound pretty good on those too. So that's the whole principle of using a phonological approach, is that you're looking for patterns and that you're looking for helping a child generalize those sounds, or, again, a pattern like final consonant sounds or initial consonant sounds. You don't even care if it's the right sound at that point. You just want to help them learn the pattern. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. I've had kids, this makes me think about kids that I've had before that could do consonant blends. My little girl that I was just talking about, whose mom is an OT, she's got beautiful S blends. And I think, oh, my gosh, I can't believe she can do that when, you know, we struggle to get final consonants at the end for words, you know, but she could say street in words like that, and you think, where in the world did that come from? We can't get up. You know, how hard is that? So, it's, you know, listen for what your kid can do and kind of run with that, and don't totally get hung up on it's out of order.
Right.
So that you miss what a kid might be able to do. And sometimes you can increase vocabulary in one day, in one session, just by thinking about, okay, he's got this good sound in this position. Let me sit here and rack my brain a little bit and think about what other sounds I can get or what other words might be close to this. And you would be surprised. That's how sometimes I do walk in a house with a kid that a mom tells me she only has 5 words, and I walk out that she said 25 in a session. It's me thinking, what else can I get? What else can I get? What else can I get? And that takes some practice, don't you think, Kate, to sit there and think, oh, no, what words can I get? You know, I mean, you really have to be on your toes to kind of think about that. And, again, if this is beyond where you are as a mom, don't worry about it. Just you know, boil it down to the main point. But, you know, if you're a therapist and are really kind of listening to this for new ideas, start to pay attention to those patterns and those sounds. All right, I think that's enough of that. What do you think?
Okay. Won't argue. Although I am thinking, yeah, you know, I think you probably are much more aware of thinking about it. I kind of go with, okay, he has ball and bye and boo-boo. Let's do B's, P's, and M's. Simple. I mean, you know, I probably don't, I'm not as cognizant of really thinking about the letters and everything. I kind of go with, well, what are other early sound words that kids usually, if they have, you know, that in their repertoire, what can they go to next? But
yeah, and that's fine. And that's mm-hmm. all that I hope that parents get from this. And therapists, I'm constantly wanting to challenge speech pathologists to dig a little harder and to think about it a little more, but not stop at thinking about it. You know, take it to the floor, see if it makes sense, see if you can get that with the kid. And this is especially true with those kids that make you scratch your head and those kids that you think, man, we are not making progress. How am I going to go look at that mom another week? Boy, she is starting to, I can tell by her body language that she thinks this is not working very great. You know, she's going to get fired. You know, that's when you really start to kind of put on your thinking cap and think about how can I get this. Or, you know, with me, I see lots of kids, and I'm their second, third, or fourth therapist. So I've got to do more than just bring a, you know, show up. I've got to really kind of think about that a little bit and think about, you know, what might be not the next. You know, of course, we want them to talk. That's the big step. But the little step is she's got this sound. Let me see how many different words I can turn this into today.
Right. And well, and Laura, I guess we might mention that I know on your Teach Me to Talk website you do have a list of early words. I don't think it goes by what they start with or anything
no,
like that.
No, it doesn't.
But it still yeah. would be a good reference for parents who are thinking, okay, I have four words, because, I mean, my point is you don't go from ball to butterfly.
Right.
You don't go from seriously. You know, we don't want parents listening to us and thinking, well, they said if they had a B sound, then, you know, they should have a bit easier time with other B words.
Yeah.
And we, just so that parents, if they have their child only has a handful of words, there is some help available on your website as far as just early words that kids typically use.
Yeah.
And usually can pop out if they have, you know, hopefully might be able to.
If you're playing with that toy, you don't just walk up to the kid when he's sitting in the high chair and say, okay, you can say ball and you can say bye-bye, so let's try to get bubble. You don't do it like that. You've got to actually play with the bubbles and be pretty darn fun so that he's thinking about that and how much fun that is, without, you know, just sitting there and kind of rote popping words back. And, you know, and I think some therapists think that you can pop a kid in a high chair and show them some pictures and they ought to be able to do it too. You know, you can't do it that way. You've got to really play and you've got to keep it fun. And even if you're thinking, okay, I'm not the kind of mom that really plays like that, you can still be playful when you're giving them their snack. You can still be playful when you're filling up the sippy cup. You can still be playful when you're doing baths. You know, it's kind of an attitude. And, you know, and I think all moms should play with kids with toys on their floor several times, you know, throughout the day in short little bursts. But if you think, okay, it's the first week of school and I've got a first grader and I've got a third grader and we're doing homework and I can't do all this right now, you can still be playful as you go through your daily routines. But it's that playfulness key, too, is what helps some kids be able to do it when otherwise they can't.
Right.
And, you know, we see kids like that. You get into their house and you can see them almost look at you like, oh, gosh. You know, oh, you know, especially when they first meet you, like that little girl yesterday. She was looking at me across the room, and I know in her mind, she's smart. I could see her wheels turning like, oh, boy, here comes another one.
Here's the replacement therapist.
Let's see what she's got. You know, and then she started looking at my bag, and I was hiding in, while I was washing my hands in their kitchen, hiding behind the cabinets, you know, and peeking out and saying boo. And so, you know, that sets the stage, and that gets kids really ready to want to work with you and want to play with you. And so you incorporate those things as a mom, you know, throughout your day. It's playfulness is kind of an attitude. It's not necessarily something that you adapt only when you're playing with toys.
Right, because even for the mom who is harried and has a baby and has a school-aged child and has a two-year-old who isn't talking, they still have to change their diaper. They still have to feed them. They still, you know, moms know all those mandatory things. So like you said, you really can address some of this as you're doing those things anyway. So
right.
We certainly like the separate sit on the floor and play or run through the family room and play time, but for those days where there is just no way that's going to happen, well, really for every day, because even if they have the playtime, they can still do the things during their normal routines that addresses this stuff. So, yeah.
Right. And when you build those kinds of things in, then your kid is more likely to expect those things, and you get that social interaction and that nice connection that we always talk about. And then because they feel so connected to you and you're so approachable and they want to be with you, that makes working on speech all the easier and all the better. So that's why it all really does start with that playful connection that you want to establish with kids.
I think I mentioned it. Did we say clearly, is it called first words or something like that, Laura?
I don't know if I can pull that up without losing the switchboard. I probably can. You know what? This is what I was thinking about that. I think it's in the sign language section, and I do think that I called it first words or first signs, because, again, if it's those, I never, you know, we're always working on words when we're working on signs, so I do think it's in the sign language section, so search that. So you pull up teachmeatalk.com, and on the home page there, it's in the top right-hand corner, and it's just a little search bar, and then I think it has go. Just hit that arrow, and the category should come up, and look for it in sign language. And then the other place that I think has really good ideas on the website about word selection is in that recommended toys article, and I think that we renamed it Great Toys when we were doing our new categories for the new website design, because recommended wouldn't fit in all the spaces that I had for the names of those categories. So look under the one that has toys, and then look at the activities, and it tells you what words that I routinely target by what kind of toy you're working with. And last week on the show, we started talking about this article that I'm putting together right now to accompany the Apraxia Phonological Disorders DVD, and when you get that DVD, and boy, I got to write this down. When you get that DVD, you'll have, or in the section on there, it says, please refer to the website for the specific sound strategies that I use. And that article is going to be really neat, because it really is broken down for therapists to share with moms and moms to look at on their own, because it talks about, you know, P, B, and M are your lip sounds, and this is how you can work on, you know, this is if you have a kid that can't do these sounds, here's some little tricks that might make it easier for him to do it. This is, and it's got a column where this is the age that most kids have mastered this sound at the beginning and at the end, and then it's got, I haven't gotten this far yet, but I should probably do a list of target words there as well. Because mm-hmm. that would be a nice inclusion with that article, don't you think?
I do. I mean, I'm sure there's some that you do that just have never occurred to me.
Yeah.
I mean, we do talk about this ad nauseum daily, weekly, monthly, yearly. So I do benefit a lot from our conversations and just hearing it. But I think parents would really, because it's just not always obvious unless this is what you do all day, every day.
Right, and it's, you know, this is really what we talk about all the time, but it's what I think about a lot.
Well, okay, now I talk about shopping every once in a while, but if Laura will let me get off the speech topic long enough to tell her about the Dillard sale, then I talk about shopping stuff, and occasionally our kids. But, yeah, we do certainly talk about this sort of thing, but I do think that it's not necessarily parents don't instinctively know, well,
right,
that's the logical next word.
Well,
not only the phonological perspective, but just what are simple, easy,
right,
you know, and I hate to call them baby words, but you know what I mean, words that a child who really, really, really struggles to say anything might have a shot at getting out next.
Right.
So,
you know,
that would be cool if that was on there.
Yeah, I think so too. And I'm going to put that on there. And I do want to say, though, I still, though, like candy is a really hard word, But it is so darn motivating for kids.
Yeah.
Haven't you had kids that pop out candy when they can't say pop or when they can't say whatever? So don't, as a mom, don't think, okay, well, I can't possibly say, get them to try to say basketball or, you know, whatever, because that's a hard word. You do have some kids that are going to be able to pop out those words because whatever you're talking about is so important to them. Or you'll get a kid, like we just talked about, that can do a really hard pattern but can't do a simple one. So try all kinds of words. This is mostly when you're thinking, okay, we've got 30 words now. I need some help getting beyond this. Or, you know, we haven't added a new word in several months. You know, these are the kinds of things that might help you bump you on up to the next level, these kinds of ideas. Okay.
Well, go ahead.
Are you going to say something else?
Oh, just that the funny patterns or the atypical patterns. Laura, a little boy that you're about to start seeing, which I'm thrilled about because I suspect that he's apraxic, and I would like Laura, because that's really one of her specialties, is to help fix apraxic kids, and she's going to see him soon. But his only consistent word when I started was ball, and he has others now, but we struggle mightily to get any kind of initial M sound. But he has some B's and some P's and a few D's. But one of his words he could say beautifully for two sessions was fish.
Wow, and that is such a hard word.
But he was really into the gone fishing game, you know. So he could say fish. And I said to the mom, I can't believe how well. Well, guess what? He can't say it anymore.
I know, and that happens sometimes too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that's why I really, in my own simple little brain, think about apraxia as kind of a short circuit kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
It worked for a couple of weeks, but now we can't get it back.
But on a happy note, he is now starting to say mama pretty consistently.
Yay!
And bless her heart, she really wanted to hear that mama. And he's done dada forever. That's kind of his default word. He uses it.
Wow.
You know, appropriately, but then if you push him on something he has no shot at, you know.
Yeah, it's so reinforcing for moms to hear that too, especially because,
right.
You know, you really think you're going to hear mama. You expect to hear that before their first birthday.
Mm-hmm.
And when you wait till darn 2.5 to get that, don't you have moms that just nearly break down and cry because they hear it and it's so emotional for them that their child, whom they love and adore and their whole world is wrapped up in, you know, finally is able to say that. So that's pretty cool. We get to see that a lot.
Right. Well, he's getting that. Fish is gone, but mama has arrived. So
I'll take mama over fish any day.
I think I would, too. Anyway, that's one of my examples of those strange patterns, you know, atypical patterns. You would not expect a kid who can't say mama to say fish as clearly as we do. But he did it for 2 weeks.
Yeah. Yeah, and sometimes it happens. It really does happen that way.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the next section is really technical. It's called, on the DVD, it's called More Difficult Words, Getting More Difficult Words. And by this, I mean, you know, you might have a kid that has a handful of words, but all his words might be one syllable. Like he calls Elmo, Mo, or he says buh for bubble, or just, you know, a lot of moms will say, oh, he doesn't say mama or mommy. He just calls me mom. And I think, no, he doesn't. He's just saying ma. Because he can't sequence that next syllable. So if you have a child who is routinely leaving off the ends of words, like the whole last syllable, or will only, you know, it's just one syllable. And a lot of times moms will tell me, he just leaves off his ending sounds, and I start listening, it really is. It's not the sound, it's the whole syllable, it's the whole end of, you know, like bubble, the bull part, or for apple, he might only say app, or he might only say pull, but he doesn't say apple together. Those kids, in my mind, I always think about apraxia and motor planning problems because the problem is they can't sequence the syllables together. And so kids, before they're able to really move on to phrases and before lots of other people other than mom and dad understand, and sometimes it's only mom. I mean, don't you have a lot of dads who,
oh yeah,
I understand the kid better than the dad does, and I'm there 1 hour a week. You know, lots of kids that I think about as having apraxia kind of get stuck there. They either, you know, can do the beginning vowel or the beginning consonant and a vowel, or sometimes it's just the vowel, or sometimes a lot of kids with apraxia can do an ending sound before they can even do the beginning consonant.
Mm-hmm.
you know, but before they move on, before other people start to think, hey, he's talking, and before he's able to do phrases, you really have to have lots of different syllable structures. And, oh, boy, is this technical. Kate, I can feel you.
I'm going to just
close
my eyes and let you talk. Go for it.
But really, I mean, kids need to be able to do, and this is from the preschool language scale 4, the latest edition of probably what is the most widely used standardized test for language, and they have added some more speechy stuff in there. But it says, or it counts as normal for a kid between 2 and 3 to be able to do 5 different types of syllable shapes or syllable structures. And so speech pathologists categorize that by, you know, every sound that a kid produces, we classify it as consonant or a vowel. And you remember from first grade and kindergarten when you were learning to read that your vowels are A, E, I, O, U, and sometimes Y. Well, there are lots more vowel sounds than that, but we are surely not going to get into that. But if you think about syllables in terms of consonant vowels, like a word like mama would be consonant for the M, vowel for the A, consonant for the second M, vowel for the second A. So C, V, C, V. Dada is that same pattern, consonant, vowel, consonant, vowel. A word like shoe, let's just pretend that a kid says, even if he says do for shoe, you know, he's got the wrong sound in there, but it's still a consonant vowel word. If he's saying by, that's a consonant vowel word. So you start to kind of think about not what the word is intended to be, but how a kid says it, and your child needs to be able to use lots of different syllable structures before other people are really able to understand him. And by that I mean that means that he's getting pretty close to the right word more consistently. Because if you think about a kid that can't really do a lot of consonants, or a kid that can only do, say he's got a handful of words, and you start to really kind of analyze it and think, oh boy, he never has any sounds at the end. It's always consonant vowel, or it's always just a vowel by itself. That's only 2 syllable shapes. He is not going to be able to say very many words that you're going to understand. So you want to think about expanding the different kinds of syllable shapes that a kid can use. And I think that is all I am really going to say on that because that is really technical, and we could I think we had a show about that like last year, didn't we? Like last fall or so. Do you remember that?
It sounds vaguely familiar, yes.
Yeah. But that's something to think about too. And again, this is for the picky therapist people. That's something that you're going to want to routinely analyze with children, is thinking about how can we expand these syllable shapes and expand the number of different consonant vowel combinations that a child can do, because that's what's going to make him really easy to understand. For a parent to think about that, the thing that I always think about is I start to tell parents, okay, beyond the first words that a kid says, and Kate, I love how you said baby words, beyond baby words, most of the words that you say are going to have more than one part. They're going to have more than one syllable. So that's a big hump that you've got to get over. If you have a kid that just says da for dada, and a kid that just says ma for mama, and ba for bubble, and mo for Elmo, and his sister's name is Ashley, and he just says ah, you know, your biggest thing is going to be helping him learn to get the second part on that word. And so strategies that you might do would be clapping to help him. I mean, Kate, don't you do clapping a lot with kids to help them hear that second part?
I certainly do. Or pounding on the floor.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And you do that. And then another thing that you might do is really back up and use maybe some of those play sounds that we talked about earlier and how important those words like uh-oh, or even animal sounds like moo, moo, bah-bah, quack, quack. You're going to help them get those really easy things where it's the same sound in the next syllable. You're going to help them learn how to do that. I think we're only down to about a minute, so we're not going to have time to finish this section. But I will say that this is crucial for kids with apraxia or any kind of speech sound disorder, is that they learn how to get those two syllables in a row, because you're never going to be able to move on to phrases with even something simple like more please if you can't get the concept of, I got to have two parts to this word. So we'll start to talk about this at the beginning of next week's show, and I've got some great ideas for it. And again, I cannot tell you how proud I am of the Apraxia DVD for this section, because I had some great kids who were right at this phase of speech development that I was really able to show you how they couldn't really do that, and then do some real therapy where you see them on camera learn how to include that second part. So I'm really excited about getting to share that.
I'm excited about getting to watch it and learn from it.
Well, I hope the copy is in your hand tomorrow. So there you go.
Oh, that would be awesome.
Okay. Well, thanks so much for joining us for this hour, and we'll talk next Thursday, 2 o'clock. Thanks.
Great. Thanks, Laura. Bye.